Hello, dear friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, and I have just returned from the Southern Glory Tour. What does that mean? It means that my mind looks like a phosphorescent jellyfish that you might find on the beach of some alien world. 98% of my blood right now is a combination of hashish, Adderall, and booze. My neurons are not firing correctly, and for the last 2 days, I've been trying to record this opening with no success at all. Everything comes out blabbery or weird or sentimental or strange. So I am giving up. This is it. Whatever comes out at this very moment is the thing that I'm going to upload. Stammers and uhs and ahs and all. Because I just have got to get out of Los Angeles and go up to the desert to a steam room where I can remove all of the toxins that are now soaking in my body. I wish there was some kind of flesh vat style water filter where I could melt myself down and be reprocessed, removing all the toxins, the Fukushima level waste that must have accumulated in my body from this glorious, celebratory, Dionysian, amazing tour. We're going to get going with this podcast, but first, I do want to thank all of you who came out to the shows. Thank you so much for coming and saying hello to me, and thank you so much for helping me sell out an entire tour. That's wild, and even though my body is a kind of thick, dark hell sludge right now, I still feel as though I must be existing in some kind of paradise universe, and that's 100% because of you. So thank you guys so much. I'm going on tour again at the end of the month. If you're interested in checking out a live Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, not stand-up, I'm going to be in San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, and Vancouver on the from the 30th to the 4th, and then on the 5th, I will be doing stand-up in Calgary. So come out to those shows and get tickets in advance, because this last tour, all the shows sold out, which was amazing, but somehow in one of the shows, in the very front row, there were six fundamentalist conservative Christian ladies wearing golden sparkly spangles and crucifixes on their necks, and they were looking at me as I performed as though I were making love to the carcass of a goat. That's how offended they were. I would much rather have had in that front row fans of the podcast than angry, wasp-like pseudo-Christian women who stayed through the entire show for no reason at all. Maybe they were paralyzed by hate and fear. I don't know. I thought to myself, though, if only people had gotten tickets in advance, these monstrous witches would have been squirming around whatever placental, judgmental pools of doom they emerged from instead of sitting in the front row of a comedy show. Today's guest is Jack Carroll. You've probably seen him on Britain's Got Talent. He is a 15-year-old comedic prodigy whose very existence flies in the face of the antiquated and stupid idea that I've always had that you have to spend at least 13 years sludging through hell if you want to become a hilarious comedian. I don't know what he is. Maybe he's an indigo kid, a lavender child. Maybe he's one of those hyperdimensional beings that is incarnated in a human body to enjoy the singularity. I don't know. Maybe he's the architect of creation itself, disguising himself as a 15-year-old comedian. Here's what I do know. He came over to my house wearing a Bob Dylan t-shirt, and when he was wearing headphones and had an Oculus Rift on, his mother told me that he wore that shirt because he knew that I hated Bob Dylan, and at that moment, I realized that I would be friends with Jack Carroll for the rest of my life, or at least I hope so. I'm glad he's here. We're going to get going with the podcast first. Some very quick business. We're sponsored by Amazon.com. There is a portal located at DuncanTrussell.com. If you click on that portal, the next time you're going to buy something from Amazon, they give us a very small percentage of what you buy. Costs you nothing, but it's a great way for you to support this podcast. And to all of you who have bookmarked that link and continue to use it, thank you so very much. We also have a bunch of new t-shirts in the shop created by the great Ron Rigi. You can find that by going to DuncanTrussell.com and clicking on the shop. Also, we're sponsored by Audible. If you go to audibletrial.com/family hour and sign up for a trial membership, you'll get a free audiobook. And I would like to recommend an audiobook that is currently rocking my subjective world. It's called Spiritual Liberation by Michael Beckwith. It really is a life changer. I can't tell you how much it's been helping me. You know, I forgot how amazing Michael Beckwith was at articulating positivity in a way that doesn't sound preachy or weird, but actually is insanely uplifting. He's like, I don't know, he's like a sonic Prozac. He's if you're a little gloomy in the dumps, feel confined or trapped, or if you feel like you've sort of lost your way when it comes to wandering through this world with a smile on your face, this guy really knows how to tune you back in to the idea that we live in an abundant, prosperous, beautiful universe where we are always and constantly and completely surrounded by love. He's really good at it. So check it out. You can get the book for free if you go to audibletrial.com/family hour. Sign up for a trial membership. If you don't want to continue on with Audible, you can cancel. And those sweeties let you keep the book, which is super nice, you book thief. All right, today's guest, Jack Carroll. You've seen him on Britain's Got Talent. I'm going to have links located at duncantrussell.com so you could see his stand-up. Everybody, please, at this very moment, squeeze as much endogenous DMT as you have in your pineal gland out and into the metaverse so that Jack Carroll can experience what it's like to be embraced and held by multidimensional, multi-armed, super intelligent love entities. Now, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Jack Carroll. Hare Krishna, Jack Carroll, welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. How wonderful that you have trekked all the way across the ocean to come to Los Angeles just to do my podcast.
That is one of the sort of few reasons why I'm sort of very glad to be here. It's a good feeling, man. It's because, like, I'm terrified of the flying, so it's actually nice to have landed and to have my feet back on the ground.
Is this your first time in Los Angeles?
No, I was here last year for the, there was, like, a YouTube comedy thing that I went to, so, yeah. But, it's good. It's really, the thing is with LA, it's sort of, when I come here as a comedian from the UK, the sort of circuit seems a lot bigger. That, like, you can travel in a 22-mile radius and do 40 clubs or whatever. It's insane.
In the UK?
No, in
oh,
LA.
Here.
Yeah.
What's it like in the UK? What's the stand-up situation there?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm not the best to assess it because I have to balance the sort of amount of gigs that I do with school and other stuff like that.
Right. Yeah.
But, it's just there's a comedy store in Manchester, which is in the north, and then a comedy store in London, and then there's a lot of, I think, bar shows. Would you call them out here?
Yeah, bar shows.
Yeah. But yeah, there's it, and then there's a few clubs around. But yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's one of the fascinating things about stand-up comedy is that it produces a community around it, an inevitable community and its own interesting politics. And there's always this pressing need to get stage time and figuring out ways to get on stage.
Yeah, it's a strange thing because the thing is with it that the as you say, there is a community and it's sort of off from everybody else, and you sort of there's an idea that the sort of personalities that people are projecting on the stage and then when they get backstage, you know, it's a strange dynamic between the what a comic is on stage and then what he is off stage, and whether you're happy with what your persona is on the stage can then feed it, bleed into your actual life.
Right.
So that, you know, maybe you're not being the most authentic.
You're talking about the persona versus the person, and that strange tension that can exist between those two entities, and the odd sort of schizophrenia that can happen to a comedian, where you have this thing on stage, which is whatever it is, either a completely dark, depressed, miserable, existentially horrified, sort of Bill Hicks, Marc Maron kind of like grumpy, yet cutting the very, like, cutting against the fabric of society. George Carlin is in that camp. And then you've got on the other side of that the kind of upbeat, happy, just silly party comics like Dane Cook, maybe. Or I don't know, in the UK, or maybe like... there's a bunch of comics that have a more kind of buoyant persona.
Yeah.
But, or Robin Williams.
Yeah.
For that matter.
Well, that's, that has just, that sort of has, that just goes to show that, and I know it's a sort of cliche to say, oh, you know, look at how eccentric and crazy he was on the stage. And then obviously he was feeling, you know, a deep, deep sense of pain inside, but at the end of the day, it's just sad for, not even for him as a comic, or, but it's just sad that, you know, that that all that creativity has sort of like, I've got the sense now maybe it'll go away after, you know, the news has managed to settle in for a few days, but that sort of creativity has gone a little bit with him. You know, that idea of, oh, well, we'll never get anything new from Robin again.
Well, you know, Ben, that is, I love to think that a comedian, an artist, an inspired person, or anybody who's putting something creative into the world is tuning in to a frequency that is accessible to everyone, and that the thing that we call talent is more a person's ability to tune in, how closely you can tune into that frequency, and less a kind of genetic aberration that happens in a person's mind, or a sort of, because if you start buying into the idea of talent is a genetic thing, or talent is the end result of a series of good or bad events that happened in your life, then a lot of people give up trying to tune into that frequency. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, because I'm reading that, well, I just read the first few pages of it recently, you know, the War of Art, that thing.
Pressfield.
Well, that sort of fills me with a sense of, oh, you know, At least I know I've got something that I'm decent at, that I can, you know, I can do well.
Yes.
But then also, I also like painting and drawing and all that sort of thing, which I'm not very good at. And the notion that's presented in that book is, well, you're either good at it or you're not. There, you know, you've either got that spark or you haven't. Which, as I've said, on the one hand, fills me with the great, oh, you know, I'm going to go right now. I'm going to, you know, I've got to do this. This is why I'm here. But then also, oh, I may as well just give up the painting and all the other stuff that I'm not very proficient
at. And that's such an easy thing to do, because, you know, the so much of what, you know, you read, like, so much of what's wonderful about a developed artist is that what they do seems simple. So you read Stephen King, for example, and his effortless writing style and his incredible, like, dialogue. It seems so simple. You read it and you think, psh, come on, anyone could do this. I could sit down and do that. Yeah. And then you sit down and try to do it.
Yeah.
And suddenly you find that it's like going uphill with a backpack filled with weights. And that's the learning curve. You're experiencing the learning curve. So I love to believe that it's more a matter of it's more a matter of focus and discipline than it is a matter of genetics, because I don't want you to give up on writing. You're somebody who should continue to work on writing
Yeah.
And until your fingers bleed.
Yeah.
Because once you get up that hill, suddenly you realize that you had to get up the hill to get to the place where you have effortless creative flow.
Well, I think this is the thing as well, because I think it is a mix of both life events and then having been able to create the skills necessary to tap into whatever that creative field is. So, like, I grew up watching a lot of comedy, and that's what got me into it. And
yes.
I thought, oh, I would like to do that. Whereas, I think...
How old were you when you realized you wanted to do comedy?
I think about 7.
And how old are you now?
15.
How old have you been working on stand-up?
11. I started doing stand-up.
So at 7 you realized, I think I want to try my hand at comedy.
Yeah. I didn't know in what form that was, but I knew that that's something... Because I had a sort of major operation on my spine to sort of help me walk when I was 7, so I was laid up in the hospital for a while.
And that was... The spine condition is part of... It falls in the umbrella of having...
Yeah, it's not to do... I haven't got a condition with my spine, but what my cerebral palsy was my brain sending the wrong signals to my sort of legs. So they needed to go in through the spine and cut those nerves away for me to then, you know, retrain the pathways or whatever. I don't know.
How old were you when you had that surgery?
7.
7.
Yeah. So I was laid up for a while, and have you ever seen Alan Partridge?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, I got a DVD of that off my cousin, and I watched that a lot, and then a few other things, and I thought, oh yeah, that's sort of good. I'd like to do that.
What was your first stage experience? How did you get on stage for the first time?
So what happened is, my parents had this sort of silver wedding anniversary, which I don't know how many years that is married, but they had this big sort of thing, big sort of party for
yes.
it. And I thought, oh, you know, I'd like to maybe perform at it. So I just started writing like some jokes with my cousin, who's older than me, but he went to university to do script writing and creative writing and that. So I thought, He'd be good to get along, and you know, I've always had a laugh with him. So I wrote this little set, and my uncle filmed it and put it on YouTube.
Mm.
So this is the thing. The internet seems to have been a big part of what has happened to me to be able to shape what I'm doing now.
Right.
Like, because of the internet, I'm able to, you know, be speaking to you and lots of other people.
Yeah, the internet's done the same thing for me, because the internet, I'm able to be speaking to you.
Yeah, I got followed by, do you know Riddick Bowe, the champion heavyweight boxer today?
And
I got followed by him, and he sent me a direct message saying, who are you? And then full stop, and then his last name, which was Bo. So it just read, who are you, Bo? which really freaked me out at about 8:30 this morning. But yeah, so it's strange how everything sort of seems to be, if you apply significance to it, then everything sort of seems to become, oh, this is, you know, this is what the path has been, and this is what magic is.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, I think that magic is a wonderful way to describe that experience of suddenly being caught up in an updraft that you never possibly imagined could happen to you in your life, where certain events coincide in just the right way, and you are able to surf the wave of circumstance that you find yourself in such a instinctual way that suddenly you look around at your life and you realize that you are experiencing a really beautiful and incredible thing.
Yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about your path. You performed at your silver anniversary.
Silver anniversary.
And then this video goes up on YouTube.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So I do the local news, around where I live in England. So I do that. And then I can't really remember what happened after that. I did some sort of... regional. So I don't know what the best example would be to make it applicable to you, but a sort of regional award where they give out stuff for courageous people.
Right.
So I don't know how that happened, because I wouldn't. I'm actually quite cowardly, and mean and vindictive.
No, trust me, every human being is, and no hero ever says, like, whenever heroes ever get awards, or courageous people ever get awards, their reaction is always just what you're saying right now, which is like, I really don't understand this. My heart is a nest of snakes.
Yeah.
But you never hear heroes being like, I deserved this. You're right. I'm a hero.
Yeah. Well, I think that they can't say that. That's why. they can't be like, oh yeah, I'm so noble, and every, you know, if they did that, then people would go, oh, we're gonna take the award
we're
back.
Taking
now.
It back, you've got to deny that you're a hero to be a hero.
You've got an ego on you. Yeah, we can't have that.
But you know, it's sort of, you know, also it's an important to note that when you are being self-deprecating, that is another form of egoism. It's a curious thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're really just falling on one side or the other side of egoism. Either you decide to fall on the side where, like, yeah, I deserve this. I am doing stand-up comedy. I have cerebral palsy. I'm funny. I'm incredibly funny, and I'm a brilliant kid. I deserve this award. Of course you should give me an award, because I'm sure I'm going to inspire a ton of people by what I've done. Or you fall on the other side of it, which is like, I'm a vindictive, angry person.
Yeah, I've always had that train of thought rather
than
the
other.
That's
why you're a comic.
One. Yep. just sort of sailing the waves of my neuroses for other sort of... But then again, I won't say I'm a very self-absorbed comic. I'm a very self-absorbed person, but not...
You're self-absorbed, huh?
Well, I don't know, because, like, that's what the flight over... You know, because I've got a fear of flying and that. And
right.
I thought, what is it about the flight that makes me scared, apart from the flying 30,000 feet up in the air or whatever? And I know it's very safe, but if anything does go wrong, then you haven't got a very good chance.
No.
But I thought, what is it that's bringing about this? And then I thought, oh, what's happening is I'm listening out for the noises, thinking that I could fly the plane if, you know, if I got the chance. Whereas what I should be doing is submitting to the, well, you know, I've got no control over this. If everyone else, that's their job, they're good at it, so just enjoy the time that you are on here and submit to the fear or whatever you're feeling.
Yes.
Just let go of it.
So while you were on the plane, you were enlightened. It sounds like you figured out the secret of all life. As Timothy Leary says, lift up your legs and float downstream.
Yeah.
It's all you can do.
Yeah.
All you can do, really. You know? And this is the verse in the Bhagavad Gita that I've quoted so many times, which is, you have a right to your action. You do not have the right to the fruits of your action, which means that it's inviting you to exist solely in the present moment as this being that's either a neurotic, fear-consumed person, whatever psychic weather happens to be afflicting you, as a being recognizing their innate talent and incredible qualities, or is somewhere in between. That's really all you can do. You're not going to fly the plane.
Mm. Yeah, you know, and that, you see, that's the weird thing. So I thought, well, it's attachment and not being able to submit to, you cannot control this situation. So how is that applicable to other areas of what I'm experiencing? Mm. So it's just, I finally understood the meaning of, not attachment is bad, but just let go of attachment.
Yes.
You know, that had always been a sort of abstract concept of someone like Maharaji, you've got on your computer screen, living on the road, in, you know, in a big blanket, and sort of just waiting for people to come by. But what that actually means to me now is, let go of the attachment of what you believe is going to happen, and know that you cannot know.
Mm. Yeah, and wow, the moment. those little moments when you do that, those little moments when you achieve that state of consciousness, it's as though you're in a completely different world. You're in this beautiful, incredible, it's, I mean, for lack of a better word, it's paradise. And when in those moments when you're not resisting. And then, of course, the resistance comes in, and you find yourself raging against the machine and listening for every creak and strange sound in your own life.
Yeah.
Whether it's the way people, a strange look a person gave you who you thought was your friend, or whether it's a medical condition, or whether it's a worry over future medical conditions. And then suddenly you're not here anymore, and you're just completely focused on the mind, on the self.
That, I've come up with a very good metaphor now. My ego's gone into overdrive, going all sort of, oh, well done for the plane thing, you did really good. That's impressed Duncan, well done. It's strange, man. So do you want to get back to the what happened on the road to the thing?
Oh yes, let's keep
is that not very organic?
Well, no, you know, with this podcast and with most podcasts, what's so beautiful about it is you can take any kind of tributary you want in any direction you want, and you'll always end up getting to the right place, I found. So however it comes out, it comes out. But please, I would love to hear more about how it all went down.
Yeah, so I did this regional thing, and I don't usually like talking about it, so why I came back to it, I don't really know. But I did this regional thing, this regional courage, and then there's a thing on in Britain every year called the Pride of Britain Awards, where they get all these sort of courageous people to go and accept these awards. And they, from that thing, from the regional one, they asked me to go and get one, which was weird because I was surrounded by the greatest human beings ever. And then there was me. And that was, it was, you know, people dying and completing their wishes and giving inspiration to people and that. And then I come up and go, yeah, right, I'm sort of funny in that a bit. You know, we just sort of, it's a very strange thing that I don't know how other people perceive me, but I would never perceive myself in that way. And I don't think most of the people around me would either.
Really?
Yeah, I think maybe it's from...
Let me explain something to you, friend. At this very moment, all over this beautiful planet that we happen to have incarnated on, this gravity well that we're stuck inside of, at this very moment, all over the planet, are countless human beings who are petrified by fear. They are in the entire spectrum of psychological and physical conditions, from people who have been obliterated by a bomb, an IED in Afghanistan, who can no longer walk or move, to people who are trust fund children who have an infinite amount of money in their bank account, a fleet of yachts, a perfect body because they can afford a trainer, and yet inside they are petrified by fear, and they are desperately resisting actualizing themselves as a human being and putting themselves out there and doing anything of any import because they've allowed themselves to be completely consumed and trapped in the horrible prison of fear. And you are a person who has, in the midst of a medical condition that they call cerebral palsy, I can barely even pronounce the damn thing, you're somebody who has not allowed that to hold you back, and you are pursuing a profession that is one of the most difficult professions out there. Not getting on stage and talking, but the problem with so many lawyers, doctors, attorneys, all of these things, at least you know there's kind of a career path you can follow. With a stand-up comic, there's no certainty in anything. You don't know. There's no, like, here's how you do it. It's just a random roll of the dice. And on top of that, one of the great fears all human beings possess is getting on stage and talking to people. So when you say you're not a hero, or you don't perceive yourself as a hero, I think, or you don't perceive yourself as someone who deserves, who is inspiring other people, I beg to differ, sir. I beg to differ because anytime a person overcomes anything, whatever it is, whether it's addiction, whether it's socioeconomic conditions, whether it's familial conditions, whatever it is, anytime anyone manages to pull themselves out of whatever the mire is that they've happened to be trapped in and succeed and do that publicly, what they do for the world is such a beautiful thing because people see that and they think, oh, I could do that too.
Oh, thank you, man. That's wonderful. But the thing, and I really mean that. Cheers for that.
Cheers.
It's given a nice, it's fed my ego nicely. No, so basically what that says to me is, the thing is with me, I've not known anything different than this.
Right.
So, I don't know how it would be for someone who had the legs blown off at war to then have to, you know, from being leading that sort of lifestyle of being able to do all that stuff, to then come back and not have the ability to move around properly or whatever. The only thing is, I've not known anything different.
Right.
So what this is to me is life, really.
Oh, listen, man, I'm not going to keep arm wrestling here about how awesome you are. Here's the thing. This is one thing that I like to do when I'm being really hard on myself, or if I have a friend who's being particularly hard on themselves. One thing I like to do is I say to them, imagine if I took the part of yourself that's demeaning you right now and put it in another body. And so that person was saying the very same things you're saying about yourself to you. You would be like, what an asshole. You'd be like, that guy is a jerk. Or if I wasn't talking to you right now, I was talking to one of my friends and he knew about you and he knew about this podcast. He's like, well, you know, Duncan, I saw that awards ceremony and I saw him standing there among those heroes. And I thought to myself, he doesn't belong there. I would be like, you're a dick. He's awesome. He totally belongs there. But isn't that a funny thing that somehow if that person is inside of us, it's totally permissible. Yet if that person is exteriorized in another form, you would never let someone say those things.
But that's the thing you said about it's just a different type of egoism. It's that is, you know, you can never exist in a harmonized, or very rarely exist in a harmonized state.
I think there's a harmonized state that you can exist in, and it is a rare state. And the harmonized state is the state of loving yourself.
Mm.
Or, if you can't love yourself, making the attempt to love yourself, including loving the part of yourself that is this neurotic thing that feels like it needs to constantly remind you that you don't deserve any of the success that you might be experiencing, and that where you're at is a kind of random fluke, and that the whole thing's, you know, whatever, just a basic like lottery win that you don't deserve at all. That part of your ego and all other parts of your ego, including the other side of it, which most comedians sadly don't exhibit, which is the one that you would constantly be patting yourself on the back and thinking, you really are the greatest thing in the world. These things can be harmonized by loving both of them as they emerge into the mind. So when you find yourself indulging, I rarely do, but from time to time, if I find myself indulging in really thinking, man, you're doing great. Or if I find myself indulging in, God, you are a total despicable fraud. If I find any of those parts of my ego emerging to the surface, I either let myself get hypnotized by whatever the specific feeling tone is they're trying to lure me into, and I spend the next few hours either in a narcissistic haze or a depressed haze, or I watch it emerge, and as Jack Kornfield says, we bow to it, invite it in for tea, and then bid it on its way. It's very nice to meet you, oh angry part of myself that despises myself. There you are again. Hi. Hi. Give it a nice hug and send it on its way, and it'll come and go.
Yeah.
Because that's not really who you are.
No. And I think the sort of narcissistic tendencies of the ego display themselves in other things with me. So I'll sort of go, oh, you know, I did a good painting, I wrote a good joke, whatever. Mm. And then I'll, you know, I'll go down stairs and sort of show it to people or whatever, and they'll get, and I'll go, oh, isn't that good? And then they will appreciate it as much as I think they should, and then I'll go, oh, right, fair enough, I'm going back up now, and I won't speak to you for another 2 hours.
Oh, that's hilarious. Now, first of all, I would recommend never, ever, anytime I write a joke and share it with people that aren't in an audience, I think that's a really dangerous thing to do, because what can happen is when you do that, you're coming across a person who knows, maybe they were just looking at pictures of beheaded children on the internet. You know, maybe they just found out, who knows what moods, the mind state they're in, but they're definitely not in a state where they want to see a comedy show.
Yeah.
And having somebody run a joke by you is very similar to somebody running a dream by you. You're just sort of like, all right, here we go, great. Well, so, because they're not in that position. So you might have a great joke and you're using them as the gauge for whether it's got legs or not, and then the joke dies by the wayside when it could have been something really fantastic. I wouldn't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, that's a I've got story about. So I did a joke on, I don't know whether it was the final or semi of the talent show thing, but I did this joke, which was equating Simon Cowell to Kim Jong-un or whatever.
Yes.
Which so
pretty
I did that. I did the joke in the living room of a relative.
And
it went dead, and I thought, but I've written a really good joke. So I did it, and then, you know, it's, you know, it worked really well. So the thing is, you can, there seems to already be an advantage when there's an audience that have come out specifically to see comedy, because it's all, they're already willing to submit, if you know what I mean, to the experience again.
Yes.
of you know, they're ready to go, okay, make us laugh and we will laugh.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's exactly. The condition is there for you to make people laugh.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, God, like, you know, running jokes by, I like so many, I can remember running, in the early days, I'd like make the treacherous mistake of trying to run jokes by my mom. It'd be better to like try to make an anaconda laugh or something, because she didn't necessarily want me to be a comedian. So it's like, even if she thought it was funny, which, by the way, when I first started comedy, I was nowhere near as funny as you are. And but so I'm sure my jokes were real rotten eggs anyway. But any kind of like running a joke by my mom was like just an affirmation that her son was on the most wrong path a person could possibly be on. I learned that it's better to just run the jokes by a crowd. Now, speaking of parents, it seems like your parents are incredibly supportive and are behind you in this in pursuit.
Yeah, they're great. They're really good. I'm very lucky to have the people that, you know, I do have around me. And, you know, some people aren't that lucky and they suppress the creativity or whatever, you know, the person feels drawn to. But, yeah, I just, they're great, man. You know, I love them a lot, and they're brilliant.
What do you think is the greatest impediment for you right now when it comes to growing as a comedian?
I don't know. I would say maybe just you've got to keep getting up, haven't you? And you know, I've got, you know, I've got other people to think about. So, you know, my dad's working and that sort of thing. So it's not, and my mum as well. So it's not the easiest to be able to drive to gigs, but you know, my aim is 2 a week, so if I carry on, you know, getting up, then, you know, and then you get a better sense of what works and you know, what's good. But I've just finished filming a thing, and that, you know, I did, and then after that I sort of did 2 gigs last week in the same night, so that was really good. You know, to be able to double up and sort of get that amount of stage time in during a night, that was great.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's one of the, man, that is one of the, like, it's so, like, you're a really inspiring person, man. You're very inspiring for me as a comic, and I think you're very inspiring for probably a lot of you lazy comedians out there like me. Because, like, I'll use as an excuse for not going on stage, I'll use, like, a mild hangover. You know, like, just the mildest of hangovers. And I'll be like, oh, I'm so sorry, I've got to cancel. You know, it's a really cool thing to, it's really cool to see you addressing these challenges and definitely overcoming them, man. You are truly, like, you've had massive success as a comic for the relatively short time that you've been doing stand-up. How long? 4 years?
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Yeah, it's insane, man. But I think the thing is with that, it was very strange because there's a lot of things that you have to learn. Like, I have to learn maths. I have to learn science.
Right.
But it seemed almost intuitive that I knew what was funny, and that's the only applicable skill that I've got in the world. Like, I don't know which comic said it, but sort of, if you threw any comedian in Japan, they could cobble together a street show and get some stilts and start walking about and juggling, and they'd find a way to get by.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it is an amazing, don't worry, that's Foxy, yelps at anything. It is an amazing thing. Now, but here's an observation I want to make. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to keep puffing up your ego here, but it's just that when I was your age, I was essentially just a gelatinous mass of, like, no ambition, a sort of, like, blob thing that had no sense of any kind of no discipline, no sense of any kind of, like, goal other than just finding, like, a good place to play video games. Not much has changed, but so it's really interesting talking to you because I don't feel like I'm talking to a 15-year-old.
Yeah, I'm weird, I think, that way, and I think that definitely has its positives and it definitely has its detriments, but I think if you can find an outlet for that strangeness and that weirdness, which I think, again, is another product of the internet that I've been able to sort of... Because, like, I was thinking 30 years ago what would have happened. I would have been sat in the corner of a classroom, occasionally beaten with sticks. Because of the internet,
yes.
I'm able to actually do stuff, and you know that I enjoy, instead of being attacked with a metal cord by some council-sanctioned bully in a suit, which hasn't really changed.
Council-sanctioned bully? That's awesome!
It's just that that hasn't really changed. They're just not allowed to use weapons anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So, are you... Wait, where do you go to school?
Should I give out my school?
No. You go to a public school.
What would that be? So, not paid for.
Right.
Yeah, so is that not...
Are you treated like a god at your school?
Well, when I go in, but...
Yes,
like,
you are. The answer is yes,
no,
you are.
No, no.
Because the pause you're doing, you've got to...
No, because I managed to sort of tee it up before I got famous that I sort of... I pissed enough people off that's unchangeable. But I've got, you know, I've got a decent group of friends or whatever. But yeah, and I also have a weird timetable, so I'll go it. You know, because you know it is pretty painful sitting on a science stool for however many hours at a time. Like, I can't do that. So I've got a sort of reduced timetable, which I'm able to.
That's
to
beautiful.
Do. It's good. It's good, and they've been really helpful. It's just I think there's something deeply, deeply wrong with the education system as a whole at the minute. There's, and I don't know how it is here, but there's just... I always say it like, education is brilliant, but it's schooling that's the problem.
That's right.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think that's... Yes, for sure. Yeah, I mean, because you, if you consider... You, like, think of the species. Think of the way that we learned for so many... So long. The way you would learn is not by sitting down with someone explaining how to hunt.
Mm.
You wouldn't, like, imagine somebody sitting down with a whiteboard and drawing, like, here's how you hunt.
Yeah.
You would go out with the tribe and you would hunt. You would go out and you would, like, watch the people who are good at it, and you would learn how to, you would learn from action, not from just this sort of weird absorbing of information.
Yeah.
And this regurgitation of memorized facts with absolutely zero connection to what it means.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And I think that's come about due in part, if not the whole, to the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
And the need for... You need... And I know it's conducive to the way society is at the minute, that you need people to be able to do stuff rather than, you know, it's the... We're not in a society... We need a society where, at the moment, where people have got a very specific set of skills... not like from Taken. They're not going to come and find you and kill you like in the movie Taken, but...
Right. I just
found myself quoting Liam Neeson then, trying to make
it... a very specific set of skills.
I ain't even seen the film, I just know that. But yeah, I think that is in part due to the way that society is running at the minute, that they need... the need for that very formal... idea of what education should be is conducive to the way
it's rancid.
Yeah,
it's hellish. It's rancid. They take brilliant minds. They treat them like they're complete idiots. They put them in a kind of concentration camp for teenagers, where you're forced to get, you're smashed into a room with some of the most violent, aggressive, horrifying humans that you'll ever encounter in your life. And in that situation where you're dealing with so many social issues, which is you want to be accepted, you want to be loved, you feel lonely, you feel scared, you might get bullied, you might get beaten up. Mm. Somewhere in the midst of this, people are trying to make you memorize weird facts. They're in, you know, like in the midst of that, they're like hammering you with all these weird facts. And the people, at least in the United States, who are hammering you with these weird facts, these people usually, many of them want to teach, but because the state is running the education system, they're not allowed to use their instincts to teach, but they're having to deliver a curriculum that is regimented and tested, and if the kids don't test well, then that indicates that they're doing something wrong. So basically what ends up happening is, instead of learning, and what I think learning is a connection with novelty, or what learning is, that you know you're learning not when you've memorized a series of facts that you'll never think about again. You know you're learning when you experience that particular sense of awe, when you realize, and your universe gets a little bigger.
Yeah.
The world you're in expands a little bit more because of some bit of information that you've gotten that redefines everything you know. That's learning.
Yeah.
Not being able to recite the presidents or talk about dates of certain battles.
Yeah.
That's not learning.
That doesn't happen very often at school, though, I don't think. You don't get that reverence for, oh, I learned something new today. I ain't learned anything new in about 8 years.
Yeah.
But it's sort of... I'm withdrawn from the whole game of, you know, people have, you know, accept me or whatever. You know, I'm withdrawn from that whole social game, so I can look at it with...
How did you do that?
I think I saw it for what it was, and then found another avenue to be able... Well, do I want to get into these meaningless sort of exchanges with people that I don't know, or do I want to find a group that you know, I like and would want to, you know, talk with, and then also what is the best way to not have to deal with people that I don't like? Well, just don't bother going and find somebody else to do. But I don't think it's the kids that I dislike, because I can deal with them, and, you know, I know that they'll sort of, you know, grow to be different to what they are now.
Right.
I think it is the teachers, and maybe that's unfair, but that's just sort of my experience of it, that it's these... Just the idea that even that they have to put on a certain uniform or dress right. in a certain way to be able to impart knowledge that... Like, I put this in my report because the science teacher said, oh, Jack looks distracted and whatever, and he's trying to, you know, get other people to talk with him instead of making them listen to me or whatever.
What do you mean?
So that's what he put in my end of term report.
Oh, you seem distracted.
Yeah, I seem distracted. Well, and then you're allowed to do pupil comments back to the teacher.
Oh, cool.
And I put, right, well, I seem distracted because you're a science teacher and you've managed to make the very fabric of the universe boring and dull. Yeah, so just sort that out, and then...
Did you come to class the next day and he committed suicide that night?
No, and it's funny because what I like to do as well is with the science teachers, because they're all hardcore sort of materialist people, I'll just go, because like one of them lives in a 200-year-old house or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just go, do you believe in ghosts, sir? And he goes, look, I've told you ghosts don't exist, but they might do. And then he gets really angry, and then I start going, oh yeah, the Necronomicon's a real book, because he's a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh.
But he gets really annoyed when I go, oh yeah, it's real. No, you can summon things out of it. He gets really angry.
Do you think the Necronomicon is a real book?
No.
You don't, but you are a person who is, you seem to be drawn to magic. You seem to be drawn to studying grimoires. We've talked about
yeah,
it a little bit,
but it's not a real book in the same way that L. Ron Hubbard's Church of Scientology, which is basically an amalgamation of all his science fiction work,
yeah,
is not a real book. I think if you believe in it enough, you can tap into the energy, and whether that's just from the words or whatever, you can get in... Like when you're reading a normal book, which is good. Like, I started reading The Hobbit on the plane.
Yeah, great book.
And I got into that energy. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm going on an adventure now. You
yes.
know? And that's just the materialist view of that, which probably is right, if you're not... is just that... Yeah, that literature is having an effect on you, which is, you know, engrossing you as a reader.
Well, right, yeah, that is the materialist view, and then you get into the chaos magic view of the thing, and the idea is that what you're just using symbols to try to tune into these archetypes, and the tuning into, once you've tuned in, it can actually create really powerful changes in your life. Which is, you know, like, when you ever run into people and they're like, I don't read fiction. You know, like, it's kind of irrelevant or something. Like, I only read biographies and facts. You know, it's really funny when you run into these kind of fact snobs,
yeah,
because they sort of discount. I don't know how many people I've run into are like, I would never read a fantasy book. I would never watch
yeah,
Game of Thrones.
It's sort of how much bee pollen does it take to fill a swimming pool or whatever like that. Those sort of inane,
yes,
useless things. But that's the thing. Like, the my brother's watching Game of Thrones at the minute, but he's also reading The God Delusion, which is a weird...
Dawkins.
Yeah. And he's gone insane, hasn't he, Dawkins?
Do you think Dawkins has gone mad?
He might have.
Well, the problem is with Dawkins or with, you know, well, here's what we're doing. This is what I've been thinking lately. I've been thinking that this entire thing that we're in right now, is a version of Comic-Con. You know what you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cosplay.
Yeah.
Right? Where, like, at Comic-Con, people put on costumes. Yeah. So, like, in the same way, we're dealing with this kind of cosplay on this planet where certain people are cosplaying like they're Muslims. Certain people are cosplaying like they're Christians. And certain people are cosplaying like they're scientists. And they get into it, man. When you get too much in, you get too into the costume too much, and you start insisting that people play. Because the funny thing about it is, it's the idea is that if you're at Comic-Con and you're walking around dressed like Superman, and you see somebody dressed like Batman, you don't go to them and say, "Hey, you know Batman doesn't exist, right? You should dress like Superman." This is why any missionary who's trying to change the cosplay that other people are engaged in, if they start getting too insistent that they stop playing whatever game it is they're playing, they will start going crazy.
Yeah.
Because Dawkins can't admit that he's playing a game.
That's the thing as well. I think anyone who knows for definite that there is no soul or no higher intelligence or whatever, for definite, everything, you've got to stake everything on that that's ever happened. If you know for definite that that's not the case, well, and it's the same with the fundamentalists who go, "Yes, we know for definite that this is what
all
we..."
All the same.
Yeah, it's the same. It's just a less dangerous type of fundamentalism than the people, you know, murdering kids or whatever.
It's almost like the religion is more of certainty than of anything else. It's like they're following a religion where they pretend to be certain. And that certainty is insane. With any kind of, you know, the people who are the hardcore, missionary, angry, skeptical atheists, they're running into these incredible problems, which is, you know, you take the Kepler satellite telescope, the thing that's discovering that there appears to be potentially inhabitable worlds, already discovering like hundreds of these all the time. Prior to it starting its work, there were none. We actually were floating out here thinking, you know, this might be it. There just might not be any planet in the Goldilocks region, which is that region, you know, the Goldilocks region, that term?
No.
So the Goldilocks region is the term given for, it means not too hot, not too cold. It's a planet, third planet from the sun, a planet that is the right distance from its sun so that water wouldn't evaporate. So there could be water and there could be the potential for life there. So that's called the Goldilocks region. And satellites have been able to somehow tracking gravitational wobble, they can determine if there's planets circling in the Goldilocks region of distant stars. And they've already found countless planets that fit into that, which means that in this brief time this thing has been scanning the sky, which, by the way, the sky we can see is an infinitesimal portion of the size of the universe that we're in, it's already discovered countless inhabitable worlds, then the implication is that we are existing in a universe teeming with life. And if the universe is teeming with life, then that means there's a spectrum of intelligence. And if there's a spectrum of intelligence, wherever we're at, there's a intelligence lower than us, clearly, on this planet. And also, just turn on Fox News and any of those anchors, and there's an potential in the universe for an intelligence that is exponentially greater than ours right now. And as that thing grows, eventually it would become God, right?
But Duncan, that's just science. That's just material science. I think that's definite. I watched a little bit of Fox News last night in the hotel room.
Hilarious.
It is the most insane. It's like what Rupert Murdoch does in the UK, but just if that thing encountered steroids and protein shakes, just rah, sort of WWE wrestler type Murdoch thing like that. It's weird, and don't quote me on this, but I think a headline on the right going across the bottom, like, can I be sued if I get this headline wrong?
No,
I don't know,
maybe.
So basically the headline, I think, and don't quote me on this because I might have read it wrong or misheard it, but the headline was, when will Black America acknowledge their problem with looting?
That's hilarious. When will they, though? That's yeah. an important question.
Yeah, yeah.
Looting. Yeah, looting. Yeah, that's a funny thing, man. That's like the racists love it whenever riots break out. You know what? It's sort of the real question is, when will police officers recognize their problem with shooting black teenagers?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that a more important question to ask?
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what? We'll deal with our looting problem when you stop killing our children yeah. randomly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was the thing. Did you see the thing Bill Maher put on Twitter about Hamas being like a crazy wife?
How what?
Hamas, you know, the terrorist organization.
I didn't see it.
He put... Hamas is like a crazy wife. You can only hold its wrists so long before you have to slap it. He put that on Twitter. And
first of all, Bill Maher has no right to talk about what it's like to yeah. be married. That guy is... that guy's never getting married. He's like... I think he has an active harem.
But the comic Frankie Boyle from the UK put back, "I know what you mean. Women do get upset when you blow up their kids."
Oh, genius.
And it got a lot of retweets.
That is so funny.
Yeah, I hope Ma saw it, but I don't think he did.
Yeah, man, that is a yeah, it's a it there's a it's really funny to watch mainstream news and to watch it, recognizing that really all you're seeing is the paradigm that a group of lobbyists and weapons manufacturers want to keep.
Well, that's why David Icke has sort of got a point when he uses the term "the movie," where this is the thing that's projected while something else is going on. And that's not an easy... That is a very easy, rather, observation to make. Like, that's... Everyone knows that pretty much, I think.
I don't think so.
But... What do you think? Because, like, but then the funny thing is with that, but he'll come up with good phrases like that. But then the thing that makes me think he might be a disinformation agent is that then the papers can discredit all that by going, but he believes in lizards from outer space.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Well, you know, the question is, it's like what he's talking about is the name that the... In Hinduism, of course, you know this, the name for the universe is Maya. Mm. You've heard that term before.
The illusion.
Right? The illusion. So they don't just say, they've been saying from prior to the existence of Fox News and Rupert Murdoch and anybody, they've been saying that this entire thing that we're in right now is an illusion. That we are living, and Maya is a personal term. So the universe is imbued with a personality, which means that it's not just that we're living in an illusion, like you just walked into a mirage, but it's as though we were born into a mirage, which is alive. Yeah. And as it's one of its characteristics, it keeps trying to hypnotize you and keep you in a trance, believing that this is all there is. And so I think what Icke is talking about, he hasn't taken it to the deepest level yet. Mm. He likes to believe that there's a group of Illuminati or people who are actively trying to trick us, which may or may not be true, when the reality of the situation is if we removed the Rothschilds and the Murdochs and all the people that have been accused of being the Illuminati, the universe itself would continue to confuse and to trick us by giving us the impression that this is all there is, and that somehow the material universe will feed the great gnawing hunger that exists inside all of us that we confuse with something that we can satiate with money or success or anything that the material world manifests as.
And that's the thing that's projected. But the comic Frankie Boyle, I've just mentioned, described Icke to me as... he's a man who's had a religious experience, but he can't articulate it properly because he used to be a soccer player.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think, like the in the Bhagavad Gita, it's, you know, it's all about people looking for Lord Krishna's qualities in other things, and I think
talk about that a little bit more because people might not have heard that.
Yeah. So. Krishna means the all-attractive one, doesn't it? Yeah, and just sort of that thing is at the inception of the universe, everything. This is how I understand it. At the inception of the universe, everything split off. So you've got these little splinter groups from the divine intelligence of money, of wealth, of beauty, but they all lead back to this one road, which is a blue.
Blue-skinned cowherd boy.
Yeah, a blue fellow in the cosmos. Yeah,
and that in every single thing. So, like, Krishna is described as Bhagavan. You've heard that term before. And Bhagavan means, like, all famous, all powerful, all intelligent, all beautiful. So it's the idea is that, like, every single beautiful, wonderful thing in the universe is compared to water spraying out of a fountain. And the Godhead, which is what Krishna is the thing that all of the water is coming from. So when you see, when somebody looks at Kanye West and is like, that's genius, he's a genius, he's a beautiful, incredible genius auteur, whatever they think he is,
only Kanye West thinks that about Kanye West.
Well, that was great, man. When Kanye West looks in the mirror when Kanye West looks in the mirror, what he's really seeing is Krishna. And when you look in the mirror, what you're really seeing is Krishna. And when I look in the mirror, what I'm really seeing is Krishna. And what everything is Krishna. And the nature of Maya is to distract us from going to the Godhead and recognizing the source that these things spring from, and to get us caught up in all the individual droplets that are springing from the source itself.
Yeah. And I think that, whether you believe that as an abstract idea or not, and just a sort of thing to illustrate that point, I think materialist science and philosophy and spirituality, they will all eventually meet. And that can be explained in scientific terms as, or in anthropological terms, rather, that people have moved on to other things, and that, you know, they're obsessed by the thing that a culture has created, which is, you know, money worshipping.
Right.
That can I get the newest shoes or whatever?
Yes.
which to me, so, you know, having, or can I get the newest shoes, sounds like a really silly thing.
Yeah.
And I think that, and then that meets with philosophy, which is, you know, the Gita can be read on one level as a philosophical text rather than a spiritual one.
Yes.
Have you seen Grant Morrison's 18 Days on YouTube?
Nope.
Oh.
What is it?
Oh,
exciting.
I can't wait to tell you. It's so basically he's done.
I'm going
to
write that down so I don't forget.
Yeah, he's done a motion comic, which is, you know, have you seen Archer? It looks a bit like Archer.
Yes.
You know, where the sort of characters are moving, but not really like a proper animation. But he's done one called 18 Days.
Write that down.
Yeah, all about the Mahabharata.
Oh, wow.
But he's sort of brought it up to date with all sci-fi and albino war elephants. And
so Hanuman's in there?
Hanuman, I don't think he's in there. I think it's, I think it is just the story of the
Bhagavad Gita.
The Bhagavad Gita, but I think he's trying to expand it. But I got the book first at like home, which is the sort of reference book of all the material and the scripts and the drawings and that. And I looked at it and they had sort of Brahman in there, and I thought that's amazing. And then I looked at the motion comic and they'd sort of decreased the image quality a little bit, and, you know, they weren't able to put all the intricate detail in, but it's still good. It's still
I'll check it out.
Yeah, because you can sort of feel Grant Morrison's power within imbued in that series.
I can't wait. I didn't even know this thing existed, man. Yeah. I cannot wait to see it.
It's good, man. It's
you, man. You are a mind blower, friend. What's going on with you? Are you do you think that you're some kind of like reincarnate? What are you doing? Here you are. You've incarnated in this very unique life. What do you ever think about that?
Yeah, it's a strange one, man. It's weird how stuff comes about, because, like, I'm just knowledge. I like weird stuff, and I like the esoteric and sort of that's a fun thing for me to research, and that whilst I'm playing video games, you know, that's a fun thing. But then this is why the podcast medium's so great, and hopefully, you know, I'll get mine off the ground in a bit. It's, you know, you could, because it's very hard to articulate and impart that information in stand-up, because you're not allowed to paint your character with as many shades of grey as maybe you'd like. So that's why the podcast medium is a great thing, and it's, you know, these, I think, you know, because you're able to express a few more complex ideas, and then these are, and, you know, with you and with Rogan and the whole thing that's kicked off, and, you know, Ricky Gervais to begin with, and, you know, all the podcast stuff. It's all these ideas, because of the speed of the internet and the accessibility and the instant gratification that we've come to sort of desire in, you know, recent years. All these ideas are spreading, and they're spreading fast. That a little kid in England can sort of find out about them, or, you know, I'm sure you've got listeners all over the world. They're spreading.
So you're like, you're sort of probably a representation of what 15-year-olds are just going to be like. It's like it's like some kind of Isaac Asimov future, you know, where you know, the typical 15-year-old, which is really just a product of whatever kind of strange conditioning is happening in the public school system, is now being disrupted by this massive stream of information that they have access to. When I was a kid, when I was your age, God, I love saying that, so condescending. When I was your age, but when I was your age, you know, I can remember, like, there was no hold on 1 second. One second. So sorry. Had to cut because of my ridiculous dogs who will be euthanized this evening.
Oh.
When I was your age, I had no access. There was no internet. So that meant that the information that I would come in contact with that would be considered psychedelic or mind expanding or different or fringe was limited to what I could find at the library. And I would go to the occult section, and I would find these books, and I would have this weird sense. And also at the library I went to in Hendersonville, North Carolina, you actually had to sign a certain thing to look at the occult books. You did, because they would like try to, they thought the information was like too much.
Yeah.
And so information was controlled. And, you know, I remember coming in contact with, like, you know, the first I ever heard of, like, Ram Dass or Richard Alpert probably wasn't until I was in college, you know, and it's a very exciting thing to me to think that really there might be many other 15-year-olds who are exhibiting the same kind of wisdom and the same kind of what's the word for it? The same kind of fringe open-mindedness that
oddness,
and I, you know, that word, it's like I use that word too, and I'm trying to use it, and I use the word creepy, where I'll say, man, that's creepy, and I mean that in a good way. I don't mean it in a bad way, but people mistake that. I think we need a better word for it than weird, because I'll tell you what weird is. You know what weird is? I'll tell you what weird is. Weird is being a 15-year-old who is completely an obsessed with a football team.
Yeah.
And that's your whole life. I'm not saying it's terrible, but I'm saying that that seems a little more weird to me.
That's another facet of me, though. I like going to watch it'd be soccer.
Well, you're a weirdo.
I like that as well. But, like, the thing is, you know how I like to annoy racists on the internet? And you've sort of joined in with that somewhat.
It's a blast.
It's the tweet that you put out when someone put, in other countries, you wouldn't have this freedom of speech, Jack. You'd be arrested. And then you came back with, I'm all for arresting Jack Carroll. He's a menace.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Trolling, it's fun.
I was looking through their Twitter accounts the other day, and one of them said, 16-year-old aspiring investment banker.
There you go.
Mm.
There you go. That's so funny. You already have a nemesis. You have your opposite.
But I'm not saying that's a bad thing if that's what you really want to do. Just try and... Also try and just find whatever avenue you need to be a decent person towards other people. And I'm not there yet by any means. Mm. I've got a lot of work ahead of me to be able to interact properly with, with mainly my sort of close family is the people that I get unduly annoyed at for no reason when I go into mad fits of... And maybe that's just another sort of... The same way with Robin Williams, you've got to be able to... You can't have everything and, you know, in a sort of karmic is a horrible, and I don't mean that in a horrible way, just you've got to be able to balance it out.
Yes.
But one thing I have noticed is, and your news coverage over here might, and I hate saying your because that has wrapped up in all sort of nationalist
sure.
sort of ideas, but the news coverage out here is may not be the most impartial or the best, but I tell you what is. The kids' TV shows are amazing.
Like what?
I always like SpongeBob, but Adventure Time is now on Netflix
in the
UK.
Oh, yeah, Adventure Time's incredible.
Yeah, that that's magic with a K,
yes.
not magic with a C.
Yes.
That, what else was there? And all the animated stuff, like the, I don't know what it's called, but... There's a squirrel and he works in a park and he's got a friend and there's a man on it who was like, and he came down and it was just a chin on legs and he was the god of the sort of world and he was just a chin on legs with a beard.
I don't know.
But yeah, and then sort of, that seems really strange that the news coverage could be so right of center and
the artists are the artists, when you have a cartoon you have artists who are all these various artists who are sort of blending together to get their ideas out there. It's the same thing, like if you look at cathedrals, you will see in the cathedrals all these weird symbols that don't quite make sense with Christianity, and that's because these artists were building the cathedrals and they were weaving in little thumbprints or little initials that didn't have anything to do with the Christian ethic. And I think that the same is true for cartoons. I think that you represent the thing that, God forgive me for saying this, but you represent the thing that the hippies and the new agers and the weirdos sort of have been prognosticating for a long time, but I think they were wrong about the way it was going to happen and when it was going to happen. But it's the what they call this great shift that's happening in the consciousness of the planet, which is a movement out of that kind of movie that Rupert Murdoch is trying to make us... I keep saying docked. Rupert Murdoch is trying to make us believe is...
He is docked. He's docked in the dock of spiritual and social...
He is, yeah.
Death.
He is docked. But he's a, he's kind of like a dark necromancer who sits on top of his tower trying to confuse and hypnotize the masses into believing that we exist in a world of suffering and horror and paranoia. And on the other side of that, you have people like you who are suddenly getting microphones in front of their mouths and suddenly expressing these ideas that are inspirational and mind expanding. And I think that the more of you, if there's one of you, in the same way if there's one planet Earth, then it probably means there's many, many, many other planet Earths with life forms on them. I bet there's many, many other of yous out there, and my hope is that
they're in my basement. I'm cloning myself. I'm raising an army.
I thought you were going to say you kill them because they're your competitors.
It's Murdoch, man. I've got to kill the competition.
They're buried in my basement, Duncan. Listen, man, we got to wrap this up, but I want to thank you for taking some time to be on this podcast, and I hope that you'll come back. We can do it through Skype, you know.
It's been enlightening again, man. It's just, you know.
Likewise,
it's a smaller audience to be enlightened by you, so that's good to sort of.
Thank you.
Yeah,
it's real, man. Really, you are. You know, I'm not gonna listen. Let me just be a condescending old man for a second, can I? You're an amazing person. And you shouldn't be so hard on yourself. You gotta really love yourself and recognize that you deserve everything that's happening to you. You're really remarkable, man. Because of this podcast, I get to sit down and talk to a lot of fascinating people. And, you know, like Ram Dass or like Raghu Marcus or so many really brilliant, fascinating people. You deserve the award. You deserve that award. When you're up there with, there's a reason that you're up there with those other people who are heroes. And the sooner you can, you can digest that indeed you are a remarkable human being, the better it's going to be for everybody. Let me just close on one weird little story, if I could. I'm sorry to be an old man and lecturing you, my friend. There's nothing worse than being a 15-year-old and hearing some asshole. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can swear.
So anyway, Jay London, comedian, I think he won Last Comic Standing, and he was experiencing all this amazing stuff from it. And I remember talking to him outside the Comedy Store about it and all these crazy things that were happening. And like, I don't remember, some cool thing had happened to me that I thought was an anomaly. And he looks at me and he goes, "Duncan, eat the cake." Just eat the cake. And I thought it was the best advice I ever got. Eat the cake. Eat the cake, man. Yeah. When it's in front of you, eat it. Yeah. Just eat the cake. Yeah. Enjoy it. It's wonderful and you deserve it.
Yeah. Thank you, man. That's I've got something on the plane ride home to digest now.
Hare Krishna, my friend.
Hare Krishna.
How can people find you?
Twitter at Fat Jacko. Should have a website, but I don't. But that's getting done. Hopefully doing the podcast, if I can get that off the ground.
No, you will do the podcast. I will make you do the podcast.
Yeah.
You should be doing podcasts. I insist.
So the Twitter is at Fat Jacko. Tweet me. And if you say anything horrible, that is a bonus, because that's what entertains me on the internet.
I'm going to have all the links in the comment section of this podcast. Please follow Jack on Twitter. Connect with him. Do not insult him. I know you won't, because you guys are sweeties. Thank you again. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Jack Carroll. Forgive the low-grade sound. Once my podcast studio is completed, you'll never hear that strange humming buzz in the background. Just clear, pure, beautiful, raspy lesbian voices mixing in with whoever my guest happens to be. Make sure you go through our Amazon link, give us a nice review on iTunes, and give yourself a nice review on the Universal iTunes. See you next time. Hare Krishna.